League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
From a meeting at the office to a big first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every event. But clothes don't make the man. So why stuff your closet with things that only work for some situations? With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting. Their clothing is understated and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They craft each piece by combining timeless style and modern performance materials, so you can stay looking good and feeling comfortable from morning to evening. No wardrobe changes required. Browse everything from summer-ready tech linen shorts and anti-odor polos to tailored sweats and crews for a night in. They can outfit you for anything, no matter what's on your agenda for the day. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. My next guest has written a book about the history of fireworks from their origins to the present day. The gentleman in question is John Withington. I'd like to say that John joins me live on the line from that there London. Morning to you, John.
Good morning to you, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Fun. I just want, are you somewhere in a sort of a soundproof bunker because you're afraid you might set something off?
Well, I am underground.
Okay, right. Right then, I think we'll leave it at that for safety measures, to be honest with you. Well, I mean, fireworks topical. Now, I'm a complete ignoramus in many things, and fireworks is in fact one of them. I know that they came from China. I know that we have a sort of in the UK, obviously people think of fireworks mainly with, you know, a certain date in November. But there is so much more to them, omnipresent. And if you live in Spain as we do, any chance the Spanish get to let off loud fireworks, trust me, they will do. So, just tell me, what was the spark? What lit the fuse, see what I did there, with the firework, with this book on fireworks?
Well, I'd always wanted to do a book about, for want of a better word, everyday things. Something that was kind of part of most people's lives.
Right.
And I was having a discussion with my publisher, and we were kicking a few ideas around, and he said he didn't think there'd been a history of fireworks for a long time. And indeed, when we checked, there hadn't been a new history of fireworks in England, written in England, since about 1949. And even that was just an updating of a book written in the 1920s. So it seemed a good topic. Like you, I was not an expert on fireworks when I started this. Some people will probably say I'm still not. but that was the genesis of the book.
Marvellous. So, I mean, let's kick off with what we know, because I think it is, we accept that this is a Chinese invention.
Yes, pretty well. Other countries do lay claim to it. Some people even say that England invented them. But I think the general consensus is that it was in China. And the Chinese appear to have invented gunpowder. So that probably is the most important single factor in the invention of fireworks. Though actually, the Chinese had natural firecrackers, which they made from bamboo sticks without using gunpowder. So before the use of gunpowder, they appear to have been using these natural firecrackers. But then they invented gunpowder, and by about the 12th century, they were creating fireworks to entertain certainly the court, so the rich were able to get them. And pretty soon afterwards, they seem to have become a commonplace thing. Now, you mentioned how the Spaniards loved to let off fireworks, and the Chinese were a bit the same. So all sorts of domestic occasions of celebrations, they would set off fireworks. But fireworks were also seen as a very good way of warding off danger. If you were travelling, for example, you might use a firework to scare away wild animals, but also to scare away evil spirits.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the Chinese are merchants, they're travellers, so they are going... They're travelling long distances through, if you like, hostile country. There's all sorts of things in China that could you know, do you harm. So having a firecracker or something like that, you know, and then I've just thought, oh, yeah, firecracker, because it'll crack when it goes in the fire. Yeah, that's how that my brain works on a Thursday morning.
Indeed, for centuries, apparently, no self-respecting Chinese would set off on a journey without a stash of firecrackers.
It's a bit like when we were kids and we had those, you remember those cherry bomb things that went off and, you know, you'd...
Yes, yeah. Cherry bombs, yes.
Now
banned in America.
Yeah.
but there was a celebrated occasion when Keith Moon, the drummer of The Who,
yes,
threw one down a toilet,
yes,
in a New York hotel room.
Yes.
It didn't do the toilet a lot of good.
No, indeed, the plumbing bill was quite... I love how my interviews go, because we start off with Chinese firecrackers and it always goes back to Keith Moon. Let's gloss over Keith Moon and fireworks, because who knows where we could end up. But gunpowder, now, it doesn't occur naturally. I mean, how is this something? Because it's again, I always say this about science. It's kind of a happy accident. In the book, you discover they were trying to discover the elixir to eternal life or something like that.
Yes, in China, but also actually in Western Europe at the time, there was a search for the elixir of life, a potion that you could take that would make you immortal. And the Chinese came up with a number of recipes for this.
Right.
And many of them included as an ingredient saltpeter, so potassium nitrate, which became a crucial ingredient for gunpowder. So gunpowder, basically a mixture of charcoal, sulfur, and saltpeter. Lots of people took this potion, and books were written about these potions. Many of them contained other elements like honey. And one of the things the books tended to say is, look, this may make you immortal, but it could also burn down your house.
Right.
And indeed, some houses did get burned down. And so one of the theories is that people were not looking for gunpowder. They weren't trying to create an explosive or an inflammable material, but that there were some accidental fires involving these elixirs of life, and somebody suddenly had the bright idea, maybe this could be useful. And sadly, as so often happens in human history, it was on the battlefield that gunpowder was first deployed, and then, after it became clearly useful on the battlefield, then it was used for entertainment.
Now, this is what really intrigues me, because in China, they are using gunpowder on the battlefield in the 10th century, which is 900 and something in old money, which this predates the Battle of Hastings. And if we think, you know, I mean, gunpowder doesn't really make an appearance in Europe until, what, the 12th or 13th centuries? And then in sort of like extremely volatile situations. But my tiny military mind was blown on the fact that they were using gunpowder as a weapon in the 900s.
Yes, I mean, it is quite striking. I remember going to China a few years ago and being struck that I would go into a museum and there would be these extraordinary jade figures carved from the sort of 6th century BC, you know. And so, yeah, China was in many ways more advanced. But what happened with the Chinese is that on the battlefield, they deployed gunpowder, but other people that they were fighting against managed to get hold of the gunpowder and work out what it was.
Right.
So both the Mongols and the Arabs who fought against the Mongols, they tended to get hold of gunpowder, and it was probably via the Arabs that gunpowder came to Europe, I think.
Yeah. Would have been during the Moorish period of Spain. Once again, are we talking, and I won't go down too far down military, but in those days, in the 9th century, 10th century in China, they're not using it in muskets, are they? They're using it in big sort of
Correct.
Siege guns.
No, they're not.
They're using it as artillery, aren't they? Mortars.
Yeah, I mean, it was used with fire arrows. So what they tended to do was that they would, this is the first use, we think, that they would attach some sort of packet of gunpowder to an arrow, and they would fire the arrow using the bowstring in the conventional way, but they'd light a fuse that would set the gunpowder burning, and then the idea was, hopefully, from the attacker's point of view, that arrow would land somewhere where it could start a fire. But then they moved on from that to using the explosive power of gunpowder to power the arrow, so it would actually fly further. So a bit like making it a kind of mini rocket, if you like.
Mm, fascinating. So let's move on then to some more prosaic uses of gunpowder, because you have worked out that fireworks get into Europe in about the 1300s, and as you said before, this is a rich person's toy, and there is nobody richer than your actual king or noble person. So things like people like Louis the 14th, for example, and that's a little bit later, are going to enjoy it. But the 1487. Now, this is a landmark moment in England in firework culture. Explain, please.
Yes. So, the Wars of the Roses ended in 1485, so that had been 30 years of civil war.
Yeah.
And it was won essentially by a Lancastrian king, King Henry VII, and he wanted to try to put behind us, to try to unify the country by marrying Elizabeth of York. So that was a very important marriage designed to end this 30 years of civil war. And indeed it did, because it founded the Tudor dynasty, which lasted for over 100 years. So the coronation of Elizabeth of York was a really important occasion. And the first real description of fireworks in England that I've discovered, now I know your listeners are very well informed, so somebody may have found an earlier one, be interested to hear, but the first major one I heard was the 1487 coronation of Elizabeth of York, and it was there was a ceremony along the River Thames, and one of the things it featured was a dragon. Now, dragons, of course, are great for fireworks, aren't they? You can have this wonderful structure of a model of a dragon, and out of its mouth come fireworks, because dragons breathe fire.
Sure.
And so that was, we saw a dragon spouting flames along the River Thames. And dragons were very important in firework ceremonies in those days. They often featured. And they featured also, for example, at the coronation of Anne Boleyn in 1533, another very big state occasion, though didn't end all that happily for Anne Boleyn, who had her head cut off.
Well, indeed, yes. Yes, indeed. And it wasn't, you know, as now, I mean, fireworks must have been quite a risky business in the 16th or the 15th century. I mean, you've got reports of people being, unfortunately, you know, being killed when the firework lands in the house and the house burns down because it's made out of timber.
Yes, well, we mentioned Anne Boleyn, and her daughter, Elizabeth I, was very keen on fireworks. She really did like them, and she appointed England's first fireworks supremo, and she was at a ceremony at Warwick Castle. A big entertainment was put on for her, and there was a big firework display. Unfortunately, some of the fireworks flew over the castle wall and landed in the town.
Mm.
One of them went through the roof of a house in which a man called Henry Cooper was in bed with his wife, and burned down the house and killed them both. And the fireworks the resulting fire damaged a number of other houses. But the Queen organised a whip round and raised £25 for the people who'd lost out.
That's in old money, obviously, not the just. Now, should we deal with the £300 firework spouting gorilla in the corner, which is of course the one that most British people know, and it's always made me laugh because people have asked me in Catholic Spain why they don't celebrate Guy Fawkes. True story.
Yeah.
So
yes,
let's deal with this one.
Yeah, well, of course, we mentioned Elizabeth I, and her successor was King James I, and in 1605, notoriously, Guy Fawkes and a number of his fellow conspirators decided to blow up the Houses of Parliament, and the night before this was all due to happen. Guy Fawkes was discovered in the basement of the Houses of Parliament with a pile of gunpowder barrels and holding in his hand a firework, which he was going to use to blow the Houses of Parliament up, kill the king and probably a large slice of the nobility and what we'd now call the ruling class. This was foiled, of course. Because they were Catholic conspirators, this became a great thing for the Protestants. Protestant England had stood up against the Catholic menace. And until 1859, it was decreed by law in England that you should celebrate this occasion. But often the authorities had an ambivalent attitude, because while it was compulsory by law to celebrate, the occasion was often accompanied by quite a lot of disorder and rioting. So there was always this kind of feeling, well, we've got to do this, but actually we're rather alarmed at the way people are celebrating.
Well, I mean, you know, if you've ever been to, and I've been to Lewis for the fireworks ceremony there, you know.
You're a brave man.
Nobody warned me. Yeah, nobody warned me about this, you see, and I was unprepared, you know. It's like, what happens when you date somebody from Brighton, Hove, actually, and you end up, people were wandering around the streets with complete, I mean, we have these in Valencia as well, where people go off and they, you know, there's a part where they show fireworks each other.
Yeah, very famous, I think it's a World Heritage occasion in Valencia.
Indeed, but Lewis was quite something, and because they burn an effigy and something. But I remember this one guy, and he had a stream of fireworks on him that he, you know, purposely lit, and whatever robe he was wearing just disintegrated. And I was like, what?
Certainly these big, quite rowdy occasions are part of the kind of heritage of Bonfire Night. And what sometimes happened was that the night became absorbed in other political movements. So, for example, in 1766 in Kettering, there was a lot of anger about the way food prices were going up. And on November the 5th, a lot of people started setting fire to, throwing fireworks at the property of a farmer who was thought to be charging too much for his produce. And 101 years later, 1867, a similar thing happened in Exeter, where again there was anger about the price of food, people chanting bread, bread. And what tended to happen at the end of the 19th century was there was a movement to try to, as it were, tame Bonfire Night a little bit. So to try to bring the sort of freelance, the spontaneous bonfire celebrations under the control of local bonfire societies, who it was hoped would run the occasion on a slightly more orderly way.
Now I think, because Handel comes in here, because with, you know, the most famous, and I'm not, you know, a part of, until Katy Perry came on the scene, Handel is famous for fireworks, and I was thinking how refined it was. There you are, floating down a barge on the Thames, Handel's, you know, orchestra going off like on one, and the fireworks going. And then I read your notes, so I'm thinking it's all very refined and whatever. And then I thought, then you brought my attention, is it the public park, the tea gardens of the UK, and fireworks were used for something an awful lot more racy. And I know it's early, but this made me drop me Cafe Solo and go, you what? So over to you to put it politely.
The London Pleasure Gardens became a big thing in the 18th century. Very fashionable place to hang out. and refined people went, but also ladies of the night would offer their services. And it didn't start immediately with the Pleasure Gardens, but gradually fireworks became a big attraction in the Pleasure Gardens. Yeah. And in some of the Pleasure Gardens, the bell for the fireworks starting was also the bell for the prostitutes to start offering their services. And there's an episode, actually, in Thackeray's Vanity Fair where Becky Sharp, the heroine, is trying to prize a marriage proposal out of Jos Sedley. And just as he's about to put the question, the fireworks bell goes, and the proposal never happens, and that's as near as Becky Sharp ever gets to becoming Mrs. Sedley. But they were a huge part of the sort of cultural life of London right up into the 19th century.
And it must have been quite a sight, not the bell, not the firework going off in pleasure gardens, but let's get back to Handel, the royal barges or barges going down the Thames and fireworks going off or going off in Green Park. It must have been quite an occasion.
Absolutely, and that celebration you're talking about, which was to celebrate the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle, which was one of the sort of peace treaties, one of the many peace treaties that England and France made during those times, because they were always fighting wars. And so Aix-la-Chapelle was celebrated all over Europe, and Handel, as you rightly say, was commissioned to write the famous music for the Royal Fireworks, commissioned by King George II, who I think during that war had the distinction of being the last King of England to lead his troops in battle, and they won. And Handel had written a sort of orchestral piece, you know, with strings and so on, but the King had insisted that the music should only be played by martial instruments, the sort that you would hear in war. But of course it became one of the most loved pieces of classical music in England, and remains so to this day.
And they weren't small affairs. I mean, we're jumping around a bit, but also Crystal Palace, which I know, and there were fireworks. Was it for the Shah of Persia? And they could be heard from Trafalgar Square.
I
know London was quieter then, but still.
Yes, that's what they say, that on a quiet night you could hear the fireworks in Trafalgar Square, the fireworks from Crystal Palace. Now, as you rightly say, of course, the ambient kind of traffic noise and so on would not have been as loud in those days. But Crystal Palace is quite interesting because it became, I suppose, in a way, the gold standard for firework displays in the 19th century. And run by Brocks, now if you're of my age, you remember Brocks. I know you're not of my age, Charles, but some people are. And they will remember Brocks as one of the key brands of fireworks back in the 1950s.
Right.
And Brocks did the firework displays at Crystal Palace. And they were so well known that foreign royalty were always showing up to be honoured by a firework display. And one was put on for the Shah of Persia. And he loved it so much that the night after the display put on in his honour, he rolled up incognito and just paid at the gate like any other punter so he could watch the fireworks again.
What do you think, why do you think? Because, I mean, I remember watching fireworks off Albert Bridge, no, Battersea Bridge, not Albert Bridge, and I mean, I know that at the moment people are saying, well, it's not very environmentally thing. In Spain we've got a big problem because if it happens during a feria, the land is bone dry, we've had a couple of fires going off and that sort of stuff, but we are still bewitched by fireworks in a way that perhaps you can't be by drones who are doing lights, impressive though they are. So do fireworks still have a future, do you think, is my wittering question?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you talk about the drones, because there have been amazing displays using drones. And what I would say about that is that technology, of course, is in its infancy, and so we don't know where that might lead. I mean, if you look at the big firework displays of today, the London New Year display, Sydney New Year display, the Olympic displays, when I was watching, you know, Roman candles and Catherine wheels in my back garden when I was a little boy, I could not have imagined those kind of things. And of course now millions and millions, well, probably billions of people across the world see those things on television. So you've got unequaled firework spectacle. Because our technology is improving the whole time, you can imagine that those might get more and more impressive. And you also have very talented artists working in that field. However, as you rightly say, there are some very big challenges that fireworks have to face. One is the worries about pollution. The other is the effect on animals. I mean, you know, I'm a dog owner, and my dog is not a fan of fireworks.
No.
And there have been some very big petitions asking that fireworks be restricted in terms of the number of times a year they can be let off. Could we have quieter fireworks? That's quite a big debate now in the industry, whether it's possible to have fireworks that create less noise. So I think it's certainly too early to write off fireworks. I think they do face some serious challenges. But fireworks, as I just said, you know, they've changed beyond recognition in the sort of 50, 60 years that I've been aware of them.
Well, living in Spain as I do, trust me, if they can, you know, after the recent Spain beating in the football, fireworks go off. Real Madrid beat Barcelona or vice versa, fireworks. We are in the middle of fireworks season at the moment, it's Feria, and you can drive past your local village and it's like you can get a NAM flashback if you're not careful, because I don't think the Spanish will ever, because they're, you know, especially down in Andalusia, we're a quiet lot, to put it mildly. Yeah, sure we are. And, you know, if you can't let off basically the first day of the Tet Offensive, I don't think they're interested.
And of course, they get to celebrate winning the Euros, which we don't get in England.
Well, indeed. And also, they light fireworks the proper way rather than sticking up various bits of their body. Right then, what do you hope that people will learn from this? And what did you learn in the fascinating world of fireworks? We've got 1:18, John, so the floor is yours.
Well, I suppose one of the disturbing things I learned is that, yes, fireworks have got better and better and more exciting. Sadly, the accidents involved with fireworks seem to get bigger and more spectacular as well. And there was a terrible accident in Lima in Peru when 300 people were killed when a firework went off at a sort of fireworks market. So that's one slightly worrying thing, I think. But as I said, there are very creative people working in fireworks, and you know, one artist put a black rainbow over Edinburgh. So I think fireworks will adjust. So there are these challenges, but I think fireworks will adjust because there are people talented enough in the industry and practitioners who are talented enough working with them to work with whatever historical trends and economic trends that they need to.
The book is called A History of Fireworks from the Origins to the Present Day. It's published by Reaction Books, R-E-A-K-T-I-O-N, and it is by John Withington, who's speaking to you today. John, thanks for joining us. We've got to crash the news. Speak to you later.
Take care.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.